Hey everybody, you're back on Voices from the Frontlines, KPFK 90.7 FM. This is your host, Eric Mann. We're in studio today with Jim Ingalls and Sonali Kahatkar on their important new book, Bleeding Afghanistan, Washington Warlords and the Propaganda of Silence. And as we discussed throughout at Voices from the Frontlines, Sonali later on is going to read certain places she wants you to go, things she wants you to do, and that's how we do it here. Very nice to have you both on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be on with you, Eric.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Well, as a totally independent person, I came to your book signing. Got lost a few times getting out there, but it was a great book signing. And obviously, as an author, you know, it's so important for people's books to get out there. People, you know, work so hard, take so many drafts, so much rereading, rewriting. By the way, I think Seven Stories did a real nice job just starting with that. I think
it's a very
attractive book, nice layout, so good for them, and it's a really good book. Because the time is never going to be enough to deal with all the things, I'm just going to open by a couple of my own sort of observations then move to the last section, which is what do we do? Mm-hmm. Because on Voices from the Frontlines and trying to train our listeners in the point is, what do we do about all this stuff? That there's a lot of very good recommendations at the end, and I want to make sure you have enough time to elaborate, including some of the contradictions, in my opinion, on some of the recommendations. Mm-hmm. So the reason I think, the first thing I wanted to say is that as someone who has been at once in my life pro-Soviet, at many times in my life pro-China, it's pretty sad that, and I think this book does a really good job of exposing the just brutal Soviet role in Afghanistan. By this time, I would say I knew that. I'm just saying that it's not like
right.
I was confused then. But it's just a tragedy that a socialist experiment could end up being what the Chinese said about it, which is social imperialist, only to find out now that apparently the Chinese have also been in with the United States to block the movement in Afghanistan a lot because they perceived it as pro-Soviet.
Right.
So, Eric, correct?
Yes.
Take a minute there, actually. Just take a minute on that. Just for those of us who had hoped and still hope for some type of a socialist world revolution, how sad that two socialist superpowers essentially used Afghanistan in alliance essentially with, well, one against the people and one against, in alliance with U.S. imperialism.
Right. I mean, China was part of the U.S. Push to support the fundamentalist Mujahideen factions in destroying the state that the Soviets had set up. So, we have a section called, a chapter called Destroying a State, and that's about basically talking about the U.S. And Saudi Arabia and Pakistan funneling weapons to the most extreme factions in Afghanistan in order to make sure that the state that the Soviets had imposed on Afghanistan, this was not a state that the Afghan people wanted. There was a huge uprising against it. The U.S. funneled money with its allies, including China, to the factions, basically to weight the most extreme factions in the uprising, such that state would be destroyed.
And on the issue of the Soviet invasion, it's, Eric, I have to say it's definitely been an issue we've come up against many times with people, progressives, people who listen to KPFK, who don't want to admit that the role that the Soviets played in Afghanistan was a bloody one. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard this myth that the Soviets were invited into Afghanistan. Nobody invites a foreign invader into a country who then proceeds to disappear thousands of intellectuals who speak out against it. Nobody, particularly the Afghans, like to have a foreign country occupying their country with 100,000 troops, which is what the Soviets did, 100,000 troops, and this was destructive. I mean, even those who started out being very sympathetic towards communism and socialism in Afghanistan clearly realized that what the Soviets were doing was not in the best interests of the Afghan people.
Well, one of the things that people that are genuine socialists or communists even should understand is the concept of self-determination.
Absolutely.
And you can't be for socialism and against self-determination. The theory is if socialism is a better system, then let the Afghan people choose it.
Absolutely.
Right? I think I learned a lot, and I want to go back and read some of the sections in more detail. But as you described it, which is very interesting, that before the Soviet invasion, Afghan was essentially a trying to play both sides against each other, which is what the Third World was trying to do almost all, in a good sense, try and balance Soviet and U.S. influence. I read that State Department's statement that said, hey, look, the new government is, we don't love it, but it's low on our list of governments to overthrow.
Yeah.
So they were basically able to moderate, right, and keep a balance between the two, which the Soviets then overthrew, which brought in the United States, which brought in, and how do you pronounce it correctly,
Mujahideen.
So just elaborate that a little bit more, and then we're going to move to, unfortunately, I want to move to what you want us to do.
Elaborate on the way they were balancing U.S.
Well, yeah, Soviet, I mean, tell us what was there before, because one of the things that you've done really great, again, is this myth of the failed state, as opposed to the destruction of
our people,
the destroyed state.
Yeah.
So tell us, once upon a time.
Well, once upon a time, I mean, things weren't great, but
right.
Afghanistan was actually, you could think of it as a progressing. I mean, it was in a state that was progressing. It was, there was a monarchy, but there was a constitution as well. There were elections to local offices. There was a parliament. Women had were in government. Women were able to take jobs. Like half of the teachers in Kabul were women in the early 70s.
And it was a secular society.
It was a secular society. I mean, it was very religious. There were a lot.
Sure.
Most of the people were extremely religious, but officially it was a secular society. The king was very much against the more fundamentalist factions. So anytime there were demonstrations by them, they were very heavily kind of clamped down. Not clamped down in a violent way, but just the king was kept a lot of constraints on what the fundamentalists could do. And essentially, people were saying that the left is getting stronger in Afghanistan. If these fundamentalists were let loose, the left would be destroyed overnight. And that's what happened in the early 80s when the United States backed the fundamentalists. I mean, so the king was overthrown in early 70s by his cousin, who was kind of in line with one of the Soviet factions, one of the Soviet-backed communist factions. And there were coups back and forth throughout the 70s. There was a lot of upheaval.
I'm going to hold you there for
a
minute. So I'm with Sonali Kohatkar and Jim Ingalls. Excellent book called Bleeding Afghanistan, Washington Warlords and the Propaganda of Silence. We're discussing the new book. I want to move now, unfortunately, skip a lot of good stuff and get to the very important issues of your discussions of U.S. policy. Because right now, by the way, parenthetically, I heard Gorbachev say that at a particular global green meeting, he said, you know, the two worst crimes in the second half of the 20th century after Hitler were the U.S. invasion of Vietnam and our invasion of Afghanistan.
Mm.
And,
you know, that's a really, really remarkable comparison because essentially the invasion of Afghanistan was designed, or the following occupation and the Soviet misadventures, they were designed as a counterpart to the U.S.'s problems in Vietnam and the U.S.'s war on Vietnam. Essentially, this was the battle of the Soviets versus the U.S.-backed jihadis in Afghanistan was the last battle of the Cold War. And it was designed to be, by the United States, a way to bleed the Soviets. And literally, State Department officials, government officials said, let's give the Soviets their own Vietnam, which, of course, by extension means that let's submit the Afghan people to the fate of the Vietnamese people, because, you know, as long as our interests are served, that's all that matters. And so comparing those two wars is a very, very apt thing, actually.
I understand that, because in your end now, one of the things that seems to be operative, this is KPFK 90.7 FM, Eric Mann on Voices from the Frontlines. Sonali, one of the things that you talked about in the book is that it seems like there's very little civil society left, that after 30 years of such a brutalization by both sides, that certain demands that we might expect in other countries, like U.S. out, and I'm not yet convinced it's not the right demand, but you're raising the concern that there is significant sentiment within Afghanistan for a very ambivalent set of demands, which is U.S. stay, but U.S. out, U.S. stay, but U.S. phase out, U.S. stay, but get the U.N. in. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the complexity of what you saw with your own eyes and heard with your own ears and how you're trying to understand it?
Absolutely. You know, Afghanistan has taught us so much about activism and about the hard work of doing real solidarity work, the hard work of really coming up with solutions for problems that you care about solving and for people that you care about, you know, just being in solidarity with and whose well-being you care about. And what we discovered when Jim and I went to Afghanistan last February was we talked to a broad cross-section of people and we asked them, what do you think about the United States? What do you think about Karzai? What do you want for your country? And we got a very complex set of responses that were fairly similar across the board in terms of, you know, people having similar views with each other. And we didn't get this sense of we want the U.S. to leave. Yet, everybody was very clear about the destructive role of the U.S. in their country. They know the history. They're not naive. They understand the destructive role the U.S. has played. They also understand that left to its own devices, Afghanistan is going to literally fall apart as it did in the early 90s. It happened before. When the Soviets pulled out and the U.S. lost interest, the U.S.-backed jihadis with U.S. weapons destroyed the country in the 4 years since. And so then they hate the U.S. presence, but they hate the fundamentalists even more. Now, since we've written the book, a lot has changed. What's happened is the U.S. over the summer expanded its hunt and kill operations against al-Qaeda. NATO has joined in, has really, you know, every other week they'll talk about how they've killed a dozen suspected Taliban or Taliban, which is a way of saying we've killed people that we feel like labeling Taliban so that we can, you know, justify our killings. And the sentiment is turning. And polls have shown that more and more people are less and less excited about U.S. presence. And I actually think that what we experienced and heard a year ago is a bit different than what's happening right now in Afghanistan.
Right. And I wanted to just add that even if you think of U.S. pulling out its troops, the fact that there are still warlords in Afghanistan and the Taliban, the neo-Taliban as they're now called because they're no longer the original Taliban, but the fact that there are still these groups that have been basically spawned by U.S. policy is essentially that you have a proxy force for U.S. policy in Afghanistan.
Exactly.
I mean, these are proxy results of U.S. policy, so that it's like you're saying we want one aspect of U.S. policy out of Afghanistan, but we don't care about the other aspect because it's not officially U.S. troops. So what we want is what we're talking about is that the need for some kind of troop presence that can be a counterweight to the destructive factions that were created by U.S. policy.
And not a kind of troop presence that we've seen in the form of the U.S., but in the immediate aftermath of the fall of the Taliban, there was a period of time in Kabul when the United Nations, through the International Security Assistance Forces, did real peacekeeping in Kabul, only in Kabul because that's as far as they were allowed to go. The U.S. did not allow them to expand to the rest of the country and fill that military vacuum. They did peacekeeping. They did not do aggressive war fighting, and today Kabul is the safest part of the country. So we think that that sort of U.N. force, not a NATO force as they've got now, which is essentially an arm of the
right.
U.S., but a U.N. force perhaps formed of countries that have never had their hands in Afghanistan, expanded to the rest of the country, could serve as a stabilizing force with the U.S. and NATO pulling out.
This is Eric Mann, and you're on Voices from the Frontlines, 90.7 FM KPFK. I'm in studio with Jim and Sonali Kohatkar and Jim Ingalls. Their book is called Bleeding Afghanistan, Washington Warlords and the Propaganda of Silence. Before I even move to a couple more questions, I want more Sonali. Early in the game gets our next announcement on how you can get this excellent book.
Well, I thank you so much, Eric, for doing this. And, you know, you mentioned the fact that there's not much civil society left, and that's true. But there is an organization that Jim and I have been supporting for the past 6 years who are among the remnants of those Afghans who are brave enough to have stayed in their country and are fighting, resisting nonviolently for secular democracy that respects women's rights. I'm talking about an organization called RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, that been around since 1977 and have been doing humanitarian and political work. And we're very excited because we have an event for them as a benefit for them this coming Saturday, October 7th. Saturday, October 7th is an important date. It's the fifth anniversary of the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan, the beginning of Operation Enduring Freedom. We're marking that day, that very, very, you know, important marker in another, yet another era of U.S. destructive policies with this event to try to celebrate the true heroes in Afghanistan. Afghanistan. And we have a special guest, Eve Ensler, the author of The Vagina Monologues, who has been a long supporter of RAWA, as well as Michelle Schacht, singer Michelle Schacht, and Zoya, a member of RAWA. We'll have a sneak preview of the film A View from a Grain of Sand by Meena Nanji, and I'll be emceeing the event. It's happening at CineSpace this Saturday, October 7th, from 4 to 7 p.m., and listeners can find out more at AfghanWomen'sMission.org, and you can call the following number to make reservations, 661-609-1597. That's 661-609-1597. More information at AfghanWomen'sMission.org.
And where is CineSpace?
CineSpace is in Hollywood on Hollywood Boulevard at Ivar. And I should also say this is a KPFK-sponsored event, so information is also at KPFK.org.
That's great. I mean, I thought maybe we could sort of transition, especially because you mentioned Eve Ensler, but your own work. One of the most kind of terrifying stories here has been the consistent brutality against women in this and virtually every other struggle. And if you just bear with me a minute, I mean, one of the things that's of grave concern to me about the at least three major religions I know about, which is, or maybe four, my own Judaism, but Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, actually, are all based on the concept of, first of all, a monotheistic God, which means, you know, when I was brought up, there was said how great it is about monotheism as an advanced concept. But now I realize, well, that means that everybody thinks, I am their God, there shall be no other gods before me, and everybody else's God is a heathen who should be killed. So monotheism, to me, is a step backwards for humanity. But secondly, the very scary issue of a combination of, can I put it, sexual repression and guilt about all forms of voluntary sexuality, and yet the use of rape as such a consistent element of the subjugation of a people. You told very moving stories about women who would kill their daughters rather than allow them to be taken because they knew what was going to happen. Why don't you talk a little bit more about that and about the Mujahideen and the others using a religious background to then carry out rape in the name of their God?
Yeah, that's a really important question, Eric. And what I want to do is I want to put a political context to this issue, because, you know, we get this question a lot, which is, well, isn't it just that it's maybe an issue of the Muslim religion? And what we usually say is, look, Afghanistan was always a patriarchal country, no question about that, always a conservative Muslim country. Like, there are many conservative countries in this world, many patriarchal societies. But what the United States did was it took the most fanatical, most misogynist elements in Afghan society. We have some in ours too.
Yeah.
And they elevated them to dizzying heights of power. They poured billions of dollars of weapons, training, and arms into their hands. They avoided the moderates and they went for the fanatics. And it would be like if some other country came to the U.S. and poured trillions of dollars into the KKK and made them the most powerful force in this country, it would tilt the ideological balance in this country, and it would make it a very dangerous place for women, for people of color. That's essentially what happened in Afghanistan. And I really think it's important for people to understand that women have been the primary victims of U.S. policy in Afghanistan going back to the late 70s. We gave the bulk of the money to Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, a man who the CIA essentially knew was a fascist thug.
Right.
And he was famous for throwing acid in women's faces who refused to wear the veil. You know, we met so many women in Afghanistan whose, you know, either husband was killed by the forces of Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, whose father had been killed by the U.S.-backed fundamentalists. Everybody we met has been scarred in some way or another, women in particular, and they're surviving the most incredible odds. Today, women have an average lifespan of 45 years.
Right.
Average literacy is 4 to 10%, highest maternal mortality rates in the world, highest infant mortality rates in the world. Afghanistan is the second hungriest country in the world. I mean, these statistics are staggering. And we feel that the U.S. government and American people have the blood of the Afghan people on our hands. When we went to Afghanistan, Afghans told us over and over again, they used this phrasing, you know, the Taliban or the fundamentalists have their hands soaked in the blood of the Afghan people. And we as Americans wanted to know, what's the blood on our hands?
That's right.
And I think it's almost too late to wash that blood off of our hands. You know, we can't just pull out like that and walk away again. It's too late. We have done too much damage in that country. And so we need to come up with a solution that includes what Afghan people themselves want. And right now they're saying disarmament. They want some sort of stabilization, some sort of foreign troop, non-U.S. presence. And they want an end to fundamentalism, religious fundamentalism and Western imperialism, because those are the two forces that have squeezed ordinary people in Afghanistan.
Well, I'm on, in the studio again with Sonali Kahatkar and Jim Ingalls. Jim, I want to throw this to you the next round of this. But here's a contradiction in your book, which is a contradiction in all strategic and tactical work. It's not just in yours. Which is, you call at the end for people to be more active in bringing Afghanistan into, for instance, the anti-war movement, which I think is a very good call. But I think one of the problems is it's in Iraq, the demand has always been historically U.S. out. That's been my politics on everything. In my book, The Dispatches from Durban, there was a guy that said, U.S. stop. promoting racism, but the way they cut the picture, it's just the sign said U.S. stop. And I said, that's sort of the basic line for everything, U.S. stop and U.S. out. Now, you're in a tactical dilemma, which is on one hand, because of the U.S. destruction of civil society and because of the literally proto-fascists that could be turned loose even more, I understand the dilemma of a temporary transition. On the other hand, the very fascists that are going to be turned loose are the pro-U.S. fascists. Then you have the dilemma as if you call for an international peacekeeping, which I think is interesting, given the power of the United States and NATO and the power of the United States in the U.N. right now, in the Security Council, what are you going to get except repackaged? So you're going to have this dilemma of asking for the U.N. plus NATO plus the U.S. to deal with the right-wing thugs. And what if the U.S. represents all those factions?
That's a really good question. And we try to suggest some answers to that question. And maybe we weren't quite successful at it. We did our best. But I think it's a very complex question. And let me think.
I think, you know, this is something that Jim and I have been battling with because we just came back from Canada, and Canadian troops have a presence in Afghanistan. There's about 2,300 of them. And Canadians are, many of them, about half the country is very excited about getting the troops just out of there. And they asked us, what should we do? And we thought about it and we said, as Canadians, it makes sense to call for troops out right away.
That's right.
Because it doesn't make much difference. You know, 2,300 troops in or out is not going to make much difference on the ground, but it'll be a political, strategic slap in the face of the United States. For the U.S., it's too late. I mean, it's too late for us to cut and run. I think what we have to understand as a whole, as progressives, as activists, is that solutions do not always fit on a single poster board. And solutions do not always fit into a single slogan. And what I think is the most important thing we need to call for is justice for the Afghan people. Justice for the Afghan people on their terms. What did they want for their country? How did they want to see justice? And justice for the Afghan people may not be as simple as U.S. troops out. I want the U.S. troops out, but it's not just U.S. troops out. It's U.S. troops out with disarmament, with an international non-aggressive presence, right? And that's not going to fit very easily on a poster board, so I don't want to just say U.S. troops out, let's just cut and run. We did that before. We've never actually cut and run. Our proxies, as Jim said, are on the ground.
And I think the problem right now is in the U.S. we don't have a real debate on this issue. In Iraq, at least we have somewhat of a debate, even among the corridors of power.
Right.
Pull troops out, keep troops in. In Afghanistan, it's keep troops in, add more troops, it's going great. Or Kerry is saying it's going horrible, but we need more troops. So it's basically the Democrats and Republicans are calling for more U.S. troops to do more hunt and kill tactics, essentially to continue the failed policies that are happening in Iraq, bring them over and continue them, increase them in Afghanistan, which is going to be disastrous for the Afghan people.
Well, one idea I had just to tell you my own response to your book is that I don't know what, you know, I think we're all grasping and grappling in a difficult situation.
Right.
I would consider, I mean, the first thing I want to say is I think your end of the book is certainly the kind of introspective. I mean, you may say, well, we didn't answer it that well, but I felt like I'm usually good at knowing the answer to something. I don't know. You know, it's not like I would say, oh, no, let me tell you what the answer was. You know,
right.
I mean, I think this is just a complicated story. You're not primarily writing this as movement tacticians right now. You're trying to bring to the public an absolute crime of U.S. policy.
Mm-hmm.
One thing to consider is that a U.S. outline is still the clearest, which then allows other forces to come in behind it in Afghanistan and say, all right, look, the U.S. left is asking for U.S. out, but in reality, the weak social movements
could
at least place certain demands on the United States. Otherwise, I worry it'll get so muddled that Kerry will say, well, you're saying, you know, anyway.
Right. But, no, we're justifying Kerry's point of view, which we're not doing.
I know you're not.
And there are other countries that have troops in Afghanistan that have extreme constraints on those troops. Germany, for example, is basically they don't allow their troops to do any killing unless they're shot at, you know, so they can protect themselves, but mainly the troops are there to provide security, which is what the kind of thing I think is what we're calling for.
Well, listen, I'm going to let you both get the last word in, but for our listeners, I mean, obviously a lot of you know Sonali. She's new in radio, but she's doing very well for one of our first shows. And, she's not, you know, and I think, you know, seriously, this is a great book. I mean, that's the main point, is that the radio show in some way is still ultimately a teaser for a book. A book is different from a radio show. A book allows you to read slow. It allows you to hold the ideas more carefully, to even reread a section. We've got to get these books out. So let's tell us about how do people buy the book? How do they get the book? Because I hope you felt with the discussion with Sonali Kohatkar and Jim Ingalls that this is a really important discussion that we've just scratched the surface of. Tell us a little bit, as book promoters, what do we do?
Well, it should be in most bookstores very soon, really within a couple of weeks. In the meantime, folks can go to bleedingafghanistan.com. You can either order it online, you can even order it through our publisher, Seven Stories. You can come to our event on Saturday, October 7th. We'll have books for sale at the event, and we'll be signing them as well. And Eve Ensler will have copies of the book as well. And so basically, it should be out in stores because Seven Stories, we're lucky, has a pretty decent distribution. And if I can plug the event once more.
Please do.
Again, October 7th, that's this coming Saturday, the fifth anniversary of the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan. Eve Ensler is our keynote speaker, and Michelle Schacht will be there with Zoya of Rawa. We'll have a video screening, and seating is limited, and tickets are going very fast. So please do call 661-609-1597 for reservations. It's happening at CineSpace from 4 to 7. CineSpace is in Hollywood on Hollywood Boulevard at Ivar. Again, the number for reservations is 661-609-1597. KPFK.org has more information as well. And by the way, I think the music that you played right before we went into our interview was music by Rawa, the organization of women we do solidarity work with.
Absolutely. Listen, it's great to have Jim and Sonali. It's so nice to have you on the show. I'm going to take us out now. So this ends our program of Voices from the Frontlines. This is your host, Eric Mann, and thank you so much for joining us today. We'd like to thank our guests, Sonali Kohatkar and Jim Ingalls, and Amanda Ballantyne. You can listen to our show next week at KPFK 90.7. We want to thank our producer, Alan Minsky, production assistant, Lisa Adler, our engineer, Jose Benavides. And we'll see you next week for Voices from the Frontlines Radio. Up next is Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. Remember, folks, 213-387-2800. Let's march on City Hall. See you next week. Eric Mann, goodbye.
It's on my legal extortion, blown out of proportion, in vain deceit. The truth is obsolete. Only two positions, victimizer or victim. Both end up in destruction, trusting this crooked system. Mafia with diplomas, keeping us in a coma, trying to own a piece of the American corona.